The original legislation in 1967 was public television, the Public Television Act. And a lot of people in college radio stations around the country, sort of in an underground way, very sneaky, working very quietly, tried to figure out a way to get radio to be a part of the public broadcasting bank account. Yeah. And they worked, and they found a draft of the bill and the people who were putting it together. And over one weekend in Washington, D.C., I'll never forget this, this is great, they typed out the words and radio, kept typing that. And then they cut out the little pieces of paper, and they got it all, the draft, and they put it in there. So every time it would say,
well, before, long before the word processing era.
Oh, sure. Every time it would say television, they would put in, they would paste in and radio. So eventually that week, it went to the White House, it went to the Capitol Hill, and radio got to be part of the, what was then called the Public Broadcasting Act, not public television. Radio got 10% of the money. Now, that doesn't seem like much, but it turned out to be enough, because look what has happened over the years with that 10%.
All right. The network got off the ground with All Things Considered, and the first day that All Things Considered came on the air, there was a massive protest on the Vietnam War. And through those early years, NPR had made a name for itself covering things like that, covering the Watergate hearings. How did the early events shape National Public Radio? Because those are pretty tumultuous times in the early 70s.
Yeah, it was just an amazing piece of luck in a way, and you couldn't plan it. The date has long been set, May 3rd, 1971, and it turned out to be a day of tremendous demonstration unrest there in the nation's capital. And so NPR had a pretty important program that day, and they were ready to cover it. Now, I must say that if you plan a program months ahead, you put a lot of things up on the planning board. And one of the stories they put up that day was a story about a barber in Iowa who was trying to make extra money by shaving women's legs. And he the story was that he refused to shave men's legs. And so that was the whole story. It was about 6 minutes long. Well, they had that story, you know, on the shelf, and they ran it. So here's this big day of demonstrations in the nation's capital, and they cover that fine, and then here comes the story about the barber in Iowa who shaves women's legs, and it got on the air anyway. So that's the kind of thing that can happen. But as you say,
but that happened over and over. That's how All Things Considered seem to have gotten its name, for covering offbeat things that you wouldn't have heard elsewhere.
Yeah, but that was just, I think that was just a mistake.
you're
right.
Expecting a slow day, and
you're right. All Things Considered, and that's true. I mean, rarely has there been a day that something hasn't come along that's been that will just take you out of the mindset of drama on the world stage into something that you know, in the long run may be more important, in the short run at least is listenable and will make you smile just a little bit.
And you came to NPR 4 years after the start as a production assistant, correct?
Right. I came from a station in Kentucky. I came from WBKY at the University of Kentucky. I had volunteered for that station and to do music and bluegrass music and progressive rock, and I did a documentary. And I did some news, and I decided I wanted to try to work in Washington, and I went there, put everything in the car, and went there.
So what was the NPR newsroom like at that era, you know, working with the technology of the time, what was it like in that, you know, early day of your career there?
We had about seven or eight people who worked on All Things Considered. The program went on the air at 5 o'clock till 6:30. It was fed on a phone line, not a satellite. We used analog tape, of course, and that's where I really learned to cut tape. I told them I was a good tape editor, but I wasn't. And I finally learned how to do it there, where you actually physically cut the tape. From time to time recently, I've tried to show this to young people, and then I just gave up because they're not the least bit interested in what we used to do.
Right.
They don't care about it. They don't do that. And but we did, and we had to cut the tape. And that's what I was. I was a tape editor and a writer. And I was just amazed they kept me around. And then it happened that I wasn't intending to be on the air. I'd had some on-air experience, but I didn't care about that much.
Mm-hmm.
And they were looking to hire somebody to do the weekend program a couple of years into my time there. And I didn't want to do it, but I heard the tape of the guy they were going to hire, and I said, you can't give a job to him. I'm better than that. And that's how it turned out. I got the job.
You talk in the book about some of the people who helped bring NPR into existence and had the organization. Bill Siemering was the first leader, I guess, of NPR. How did he and the other people who came in those early eras envision the public radio system and then help it develop?
Well, it's very interesting. And I'm glad I got a chance to write the 70s chapter of this book, because it took me into a turning point in NPR's development, and it happens at the end of the 70s. Bill Siemering, you mentioned, he is a radio visionary, and he'd come from Buffalo, and where he was doing experimental broadcasting in that community there, and he was hired to set up this program, All Things Considered, and he wanted it to be conversational. He wanted it to reflect the sense and the feeling of what it's like to be out in the community, worried about your neighborhood, worried about your town, worried about your state, your country, the nation, the world, the universe. And he wanted to, above all, he wanted it to be conversational. And he wanted it to celebrate the human experience. Now, that's quite a bit different than a hard news, straight-ahead outlook. And Bill was fired a short time into his tenure there and went on to do other things in public radio. Bill, by the way, developed a program in Buffalo that became Terry Gross's Fresh Air program in Philadelphia. So he knew what he was doing. And a lot of us are just, for a lot of us in the industry, he's just a hero, still is.
NPR has always sort of been on the edge as far as financial viability as well, in those early days especially. And you talk about how the management change with Frank Mankiewicz coming in. How did that affect NPR, and where did it take the organization?
Excuse me. Well, the Mankiewicz hiring is speaks to the point I was making about the change in direction. Mm-hmm. Should it be hard news, or should it be a softer program that does celebrate the human experience? And Mankiewicz came in, terrible financial manager. He had the biggest, I remember him walking in, Frank Mankiewicz we're talking about, coming in the first day, and he had this huge Rolodex. Nobody carries around a Rolodex anymore, but he walked in, and I said, that's why we hired him. He knew everybody on the West Coast in Hollywood, on the East Coast in politics. He'd been Robert Kennedy's press secretary. Long involved in politics, and he thought that it should be a straight-ahead news operation. He wanted to compete with everybody else, and we said, no, I don't think so. And so that his way, actually, and he was asked to leave eventually, his way prevailed, and thank goodness it did. Because at the same time, all the commercial news networks were sort of giving up.
On radio.
Right. On radio. And why is that the case? Why is WBUR in Boston, for example, number one in the Boston news market? It's a great station. They do a great job, but for the most part, commercial radio gave up. And so that's what happened. So Mankiewicz was right. Siemering was right. And what you have on these programs is a combination of both points of view, and they're equally important. And now I'm very proud of the fact that, for example, in overseas reporting and foreign affairs, NPR has 16 bureaus at a time around the world, at a time when everybody else is pulling its people back.
So where does NPR stand now with that stature and with, you know, the uncertainty that faces public broadcasting?
Well, I don't think there is any uncertainty at all. There's a little bit of concern about funding right now. I think that will blow over. There hasn't been a major challenge to funding for 10 years. And when it happened last, the support that arose from the communities and was passed along to the members of Congress was very, very strong, and that's going to be even more strong this year. But I think that NPR is actually poised to achieve a leadership role in news gathering, and certainly with the support of the local stations. I'll give you an example. Vivian Schiller is the CEO of National Public Radio, as you know, and she has said, what does NPR have? What does NPR have that the New York Times does not have? And the answer is WILL. The answer is 600 local stations doing great work around the country. New York Times does not have that, doesn't have 600 bureaus. And that's the real answer. And I take it a step farther. I can say, and maybe NPR would be upset with me for saying this, but I can say this, that NPR could go away. And the stations are so strong around the country, they could figure out how to get national and overseas news. Not as good, but they could do it, and they would still be there serving the community. And when all else fails, that's going to be the important thing.
What about the uncertainty of radio, maybe even as a medium, with the fact that we may be relying more on the Internet for information?
Figure this. 20 years from now, you're driving along, and you're thinking of All Things Considered, and it comes into your brain. Just thinking of it. It comes into your brain, and you hear Melissa Block talking about Richard Holbrooke, who just died, or talking about some other news story, and you realize you're getting it through your brain. Radio telepathy. Well, that sounds absurd, but 20 years from now, you might remember that Noah said this on my radio show, because things like that could happen. I don't mean to be absurd about it. I don't mean to be too fanciful about it, but technology is going to keep a pace and way out in front of us. So a radio transmitter is just a device, and there will be other devices. I just read that the people who make Kindle, the electronic reader, Amazon people who make Kindle, they know what page you're on when you're reading the book that you paid to download.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? They know when you stop reading it. They know that you haven't picked it up for 2 weeks. So 20 years from now, you'll be able to figure out in your own brain how to get the radio station signal into your head.
With that, I have to cut to stop. My brain may have overloaded there. Thanks for your time, Noah.
You bet. I enjoyed it.
Noah Adams is one of the authors of This is NPR, The First 40 Years, along with Cokie Roberts, Susan Stamberg, John Itzde, Renee Montaigne, Ari Shapiro, and David Folkenflik. Thanks.
You bet. I didn't get a chance to talk about WILL. I was actually hired there.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Doing what?
Doing the morning program. This was in the mid-70s. I was going to come there first and then go to NPR. And
were you ever on the air here there? Or,
no.
Or did you?
You know, I got the job, and they were sort of dragging me through the state, the hiring process. It was going to take a while. And then the job came open at NPR, and I applied for that and got that.
So no kidding.
Yeah, I called Don Mullally, and I said, you know, I'm not going to take that job. I'm going to go to Washington.